that. But this was incredible. And the truth is, if we want to share the gospel with more friends, it's not just about that moment that the guy like Eric that listens to death metal walks up and says, hey, I've been reading the Bible. I have questions. There's some preparation that has to go into what we do before we reach that moment. And so for the last 5 years that I've been at Embry Hills, one of the things that I have just loved, it was existing before I ever got there, so I'm not taking any credit for this. One of the things that I've absolutely just loved is that we've been able to have what we call our evangelism workshops. Now, I just lost all my notes. We've been able to have our evangelism workshops. And what we do when we're doing an evangelism workshop is we meet together on a Saturday, and we go through and talk about the things that are actually going to sharpen us and strengthen us to be more evangelistic. And as we're doing that, there it is. Okay. And we're doing that. This was some of the ideas that we were dealing with. How can we prepare ourselves so that when we get in that situation where a friend wants to read the Bible or somebody thinks it's really weird that you're getting up at the crack of dawn on Sunday and you're going to church, like that you're ready to take some steps. So when we talk about having small steps, yes, we're thinking about things that lead to big outcomes. Things that actually change the direction of someone's life, things that actually can lead to their salvation. And there's a bunch of those, right? There's things that we can do that will emphasize God in unexpected ways, help people see God and how different He is. There are things that we could do that would share the good news in ways that it's easier for people to process. And that's kind of be like the bulk of what we're going to do in the next 30 or 40 minutes. And then there are things that we can do that lead to unexpected opportunities. So if you've got your Bibles there in Matthew chapter 16, I want you to read verse 21 to 23. Can I get somebody to read that just out loud for us? 21 to 23 in Matthew 16. Who can I call on? Careful, I only know a few names. Connor, boom, 21 to 23. Matthew 16. It's okay. Hey, I love that you're taking some notes. Matthew 16, 21 to 23. All right. So this is wild, right? You remember just a few verses earlier in Matthew chapter 16, what did Peter say about Jesus? Yeah, you're Jesus. You're the Christ. And yet here, this crazy thing happens that Jesus says, I'm going to go die. And I want you to consider for a moment how Peter is responding to this. No! And Jesus has to stop him. And what's in blue on the screen, you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but on man's. So it seems to be that Jesus is saying to us, hey, because I have my interest set on the things that God is interested in, this actually doesn't seem so crazy after all. I mean, it's going to be like painful, but it's not crazy. It's not unreasonable. It's actually extremely reasonable because this is going to accomplish the interest of God. You get like that's what he's doing here. So what is it that Jesus actually has in mind that would make going to Jerusalem to suffer many things and be killed reasonable? What does he have on his mind that would make that reasonable? Okay, God's interest, that's the general category. What are God's interests here? That he's like, yeah, I'll do this because this is the payoff. Oh, no, come on, this is kind of a T-ball question. Listen, we're going to get to much harder things where it's guess what Philip is thinking, and I know I'm totally guilty of that sometimes. But what is Jesus genuinely interested in here that is pleasing to the Father? Us? Right? Like washing our sins away, building his church, like saving the world. You know this, right? Look at this passage. Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? What will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels and will then repay every man according to his deeds. I would say that you and I are going to have to do some things that seem crazy to the rest of the world watching us. But to us, they make perfect sense. To us, they make sense because we would really like to be repaid by God and receive good things. We would actually give up our dream job or our dream vehicle or our dream vacation so that we could go to heaven. In fact, we would give up our dream job or our dream vehicle or our dream vacation to help somebody else go to heaven. Because, like, to us, that's just much more valuable. And so it seems really crazy, but it actually makes all the sense in the world. Let me show you one about Gideon for a moment. Think about Gideon and this really weird thing he does. He has a huge opportunity set in front of him in Judges chapter 8, verse 22 and 23. The men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's sons, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." When was the last time you turned down being the king? And not even just being the king, but like establishing a dynasty where your children after you get to be large and in charge and have all the privileges that come with being the king. Like, Gideon, we like you a lot, man. You need to be our king. And he turns it down. Here's an evangelism opportunity for you guys. And we learn this from Gideon. He turns down the throne because he knew God was the true king. There is a great chance for you to speak up about God when we do not pursue the status or the wealth of the world. When you're actually able to say to somebody, "Yeah, I know I could work overtime, and I know that like they pay time and a half or they pay double time, but actually I have somewhere to be on Sunday, and I'm not going to miss that." And they go, "Dude, why are you turning down the extra hours? Why are you turning down the annual bonus? Why are you turning..." Because it's not crazy. It's reasonable to put God first. So think about Gideon and the kind of opportunity he creates. Think about Noah for a minute. This one is just super strange. Noah in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, "If God," and then verse 5, "if God did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly." Wait, what? Noah was a preacher of righteousness when everyone around him in the world was so ungodly that God was just done with it and ready to wipe the whole thing out. When you think about Noah, there's a step there. He is actually willing to preach and to teach. He's willing to tell people about God and about righteousness, which, you know, our world has a tolerance for everything except righteousness. He's willing to tell people about righteousness because he knew as long as God was delaying, there was a chance to warn others. And because we have that chance. We have this opportunity to tell people how they can be saved. And it's not about, oh, joining our church and growing our numbers and expanding our building or filling the... No! It's about going to heaven. It's about being the people God has created and designed us to be. So he's going to take advantage of that. And of course, that doesn't always go well. Like, nobody else got to join on the ark, right? Not everybody will listen. But it's still the right thing. And what I love about Paul, when he was just trying to be evangelistic, but it didn't make any sense why he would keep pushing himself through these difficult circumstances, is what we find here in Acts 17. "When they traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews, and according to Paul's customs, he went to them, and for three Sabbaths he reasoned with them from the Scriptures." Now, that's all that fits up there, so I need a reader again. Who would hit verse 5 through 10? Acts chapter 17, verse 5 to 10. Would somebody read that for us? Acts 17. Yes, sir. Thanks.
Them, and they are all acting against the decrees of Caesar. saying that there is another king, Jesus. And the people in the city authorities were disturbed when they heard these things. And when they had taken money as security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. The brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. When they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue.
Thank you. You know, sometimes you're going to be having a Bible study with a friend, or you're going to be answering somebody's questions, and they're going to go, "Ooh, that's weird. I'm not sure about that." I'm studying with a young woman right now named Sharon, and she grew up in China, and she knows very little about the Bible. We've been studying now for almost 2 years, and a lot of things that she reads in the Bible don't make a lot of sense, especially the supernatural elements and the miracles. So she's, you know, also learning about American television since moving here, and she's watching old episodes of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which is way before you guys. But she's like, "Hey, this is kind of like that, where like they wiggle their nose and something happens and nobody," I'm like, "Well, it is supernatural, but it's not exactly Sabrina the Teenage Witch." Like, but she's trying to figure this stuff out. And she's a joy to study with. There are other people that they don't. Like, you start studying with them, and they're like, "Oh, I'm going to come to church," and then they never show up, right? Or, like, you start studying with them, and they go, "You can't say that. My brother is a homosexual. I don't want to hear that." Or, "You can't say this." Or, "God, I don't like this whole concept of hell. No. What Paul does in Thessalonica is a huge lesson for us. Remember how Jesus told his apostles he's going to shake the dust off their feet and move on to another city? Sometimes you have to know when to move on. And it's not that you move on when someone stumbles or is weak. There are some people I study the Bible with, and like we go through everything that they need to do and what can like help their family and help raise up their kids, and we meet again in 2 weeks. I'm like, "Hey, did you do those things?" And they're like, "I did one of them on Tuesday, but none of the other days." I'm like, "Oh." And I was talking to a deacon buddy of mine. I was like, "Man, I don't know if I'm going to keep doing this study and keep doing this study and meeting this guy and meeting this guy and meeting this guy." And he said, whoa. He said, "He hasn't pushed you away. He's struggling, and he's weak, but he still wants to know, and he still wants to do better, and he still wants to develop these habits." What I learned here from Paul is that I'm going to keep going until they literally are asking me not to. I'm going to keep going until it's getting so difficult, and they're pushing so much that you're just not even welcome there anymore. I want to tell you to keep going, even when they're weak, even when they're confused. Unless you are literally unwelcome, then you push that conversation forward. Now, you look at all these examples, whether it's Gideon or Paul or Noah, and I get it. That just feels hard. It literally feels hard to take these kind of steps and to try to be different and to try to plant this seed and water this seed when it seems like so few people actually believe in fully following Jesus. Now, there are plenty of people that are happy to do this thing where they're like, "Oh yeah, Jesus is God, but I'm not going to like follow him, and I'm certainly not going to give up my dream job for him, or I'm not going to change my marriage for him, or I'm not going to like change my finances." Like, I mean, he's Jesus. It's the whole Lord, Lord thing from Matthew 7, right? They call him Lord, but they don't actually do what he wants. They don't really fully follow him. So I want to give you a key that can help you break through some of that. There's this little book, the author, his name is Sam Chan, and the book is called How to Talk About Jesus Without Being That Guy. And you get it, right? How to talk about Jesus without being the one that is just like beating them over the head with religion. And he gives this example. So let's say for a moment that you grew up and your parents are like super hippies, okay? And they're into all the craziness and they're always into conspiracy theories. And like for your family vacation, you went to Area 51 and your parents explained how the government was hiding the aliens behind the barbed wire fence, okay? If that was your background, and then you met someone and they said, "Hey, listen, I have to tell you this most amazing thing that ever happened. Last night I was out at the grill in the backyard and suddenly there were all of these flashing circle lights in the air and they started coming down." If your background was hippie parents and vacations to Area 51, what would you expect that? "Oh yeah, mom and dad told me all about that," right? But I'm going to just guess For most of us, if I come to you and go, hey, I got to tell you about the most amazing experience I had. And like last night I was grilling the hamburgers and I looked up and there were all these circle lights and they came down and I like jumped in their spaceship and we went to Venus and we came back and here I am this morning. You would be like, okay. Let me just back away. So let me just tell you this story. There was this guy that lived 2,000 years ago, and you need to be exactly like him. You need to do everything, because what you are walking around in this physical body, it's not even, like, important. You have this, like, energy inside of you, and we call it a soul, and it's going to live forever somewhere in a cloudy, golden place. And people are like, whoa, what did you grow up with? What I want you to see, and what Mr. Sam Chan makes as his point, is that when we share the gospel with people, sometimes we're talking to our friends, and it is unbelievable to them that you would change your whole life to follow these morals and these standards of righteousness that are so countercultural. And it is unbelievable to them that you actually believe that this body, when it dies, is going to be resurrected and it is going to be radically transformed and it is going to live forever in eternity with these supernatural beings that we call angels. That does not process for most people that are far away from God. And so what Mr. Chan points out is that when you want people to actually process information that seems almost unbelievable based on their background, you need three things. They're called plausibility structures or plausibility factors. These three factors make the unbelievable believable. And I already set this up for you with the story about the person raised by the hippies going to Area 51. The first is the community you're in. If you try to come and tell me that... here's a good one. Ultra marathons have changed your life and that you just love running 100 miles. I'm like, my feet are tired just thinking about that. Okay. But you tell me, no, Philip, you got to listen to this. I am part of this club and we meet on Thursdays and we are all ultra marathon runners and it's unbelievable. It's so great. And I've never felt better in my life. And I have this sense of accomplishment and self-esteem and it's just direction. And these friends are so cool and we hang out on the weekends. I'm like, well, then I need to at least meet your friends. But I'm not running, like, I will at least meet your friends. And then I meet all these people, and they're like normal human beings. They just don't eat as many Oreos as I do. And they're like, okay, well, like, maybe this is kind of cool. Maybe this is enjoyable. And so the community that you're exposed to makes the claim more believable. Not just the community, but maybe the experience. And they're like, hey, listen, look, I know, Philip, you're not like ready to completely commit and sign up for your very first ultra marathon, but like me and some of the guys, we're going camping this weekend, and we're just going to do this 6-mile hike. And we're going to do 3 miles one day, we're going to camp out by a waterfall, and we're going to do 3 miles back the next day. You can do 3 miles, can't you? I go, actually, I love swimming in waterfalls. That sounds great. And your friends, I've already met them. That's pretty cool. I'll go with you for this hike. And then that's pretty cool. And then your buddy wants to kind of close the deal and they give you facts and information. And they come and they tell you that, hey, you know, you are the age where your muscles will do whatever you train them to do. And you would only really have to give this much attention and this much time. And you actually can do this thing that seemed previously impossible. And suddenly I'm like, maybe I will run an ultra marathon. Maybe I can do that, right? And then you come back to reality. But, you know, for a minute, it's plausible. Because the community and the experience and the facts and information make the whole picture more reasonable. And here's what we do all the time, guys. We put giant red lights in front of our friends and neighbors when we ask them to believe biblical concepts and all we use is the last one on the list. All we use are facts and information. And we don't use anything about experience. We don't use anything about community. And if you're just driving down the street and you see a red light, you hit the brakes. And if I start telling you a story about, no, yellow light, we speed up, but red, we hit the brakes. Okay. You see the red light, you hit the brakes. If I start telling you the story about the UFOs, you hit the brakes immediately. You know that I'm just like being fictional and joking and making a point. And when we start telling our friends and neighbors, like, oh, no, like, I genuinely believe that marriages are stronger than when there are submissive wives. Yeah, that's real popular, right? People hit the brakes. They're like, I can't go any further with you. And I'm like, no, it's in the Bible. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, no, look, it's right here in Ephesians. And all I did was give them facts and information. But if I had that same person over to my home and they see how happy my kids are, right? And they see the amazing marriage that we have, and they see the way I take care of her and she takes care of me and the love and the respect that exists there. It's like, oh, now this makes sense. So what I want to do is give you guys some tips that are going to help us in sharing the gospel, in taking that living water Eric talked about, moving it towards the lost, towards those that are dead in their sins, and making these things more believable. So let's start here with Paul. And let me just give you the passage. Go over here to Acts chapter 22. Acts chapter 22. And walk through this with me. Acts chapter 22 in verse 1 through 5. In fact, I do want to read some of this. Acts 22 verse 1 through 5. Look at the way Paul actually uses all three of these factors when he's on trial. Acts 22, we're going to pick up in verse 1. Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you. When they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. He said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in the city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. And I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prison. And also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify. From them I also received letters to the brethren and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. Do you see how his whole introduction in this comment is, I am one of you. You know, and you've got to have that. You've got to be able to look at your roommates. You've got to be able to look at your classmates and go, hey, look, I like to have fun on the weekend as much as the next guy, but I don't drink. I don't want to even touch it. I want to be as sober-minded as the Bible has me to be sober-minded. Like, you have to be able to talk to your friends and neighbors and say, I am one of you. I like to do these things, but I've made this different choice. And Paul starts by showing them how much they have in common in verse 1 through 5. Come with me to verse 6 through 10. But it happened, as I was on my way approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. And you can see that red light coming for a second. Like, I don't know if I believe in that, right? But he goes on, I fell to the ground and I heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And I answered it, and they said, who are you, Lord? He said, I am Jesus the Nazarene whom you're persecuting. Those who were with me saw the light to be sure, but they did not understand the voice of the one speaking to me. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, get up, go on into Damascus. There you'll be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. But since I could not see because of the brightness of the light, I was led by the hand to those who were with me, and I came into Damascus. So he had this amazing experience, and he wants to tell them about that. And look, there's just times that we have to do that. We have to come to somebody and say, hey, listen, I'm glad we're reading the Bible, or I'm glad you asked me this question, but I just need you to know, I went to this really cool thing this weekend, and I got to hang out with a lot of Christians, and I was not the only one there, and we all were paying attention to what the Bible, like, we were learning this. And then I got in this really hard situation one day, and I was able to remember that God actually knew the answer to that question. And I'd already learned that. And that helped me through. That helped me navigate this really tough choice. We have things in our experience to share. And then, of course, the last one that's here on the screen, these are the people and places. These are the people I met and the places I went. Verse 12, a certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, he came to me standing near and said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very time, I looked up at him. He said, the God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name. You just get this whole picture here. That's not just the facts and information about Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, but is more than that. I want you guys to go to Acts 26 for a minute. Please go to Acts chapter 26. And I'm just going to give you a minute. Look at Acts chapter 26. Kind of skim through the first 23 verses. Acts chapter 26. Skim through the first 23 verses and see what you can find. See if Paul did this again when he was with Agrippa. What kind of facts and information do you see in Acts 26 that he brought out and shared? What do you see in Acts 26 about the community that he was a part of? What do you see in Acts 26 about the experiences that he had? See what you can find in that chapter for a minute, and then we'll discuss it. Yeah, and you're totally welcome to talk to your friends and neighbors here. All right, what kind of things have started to jump out at you? What have you seen about the community, the things that he might have in common with Agrippa? What have you seen here about experience that he would want to share with them? What kind of facts and information does he relate to Agrippa? Let's just start maybe with community. Do you see anything that he does or says that would build a sense of community in this conversation? What did you guys pick up on? Yeah? Yeah, great. So some common ground is like, you are familiar with the prophets. I know we have that in common. What else? Look in verse 3. What does he say about him in verse 3? Yeah, you're an expert in Jewish matters. Like, you know all about our beliefs and our system and our people. You really are an expert. Like, you're too smart not to hear what I have to say. Wouldn't you love to talk with, like, one of your friends, your classmates, to be like, look, dude, I've learned a ton from you about physics. I've learned a ton from you about engineering. I've learned a ton from you about social work. Like, whatever your major is, I've learned a ton from you about this. You are too smart not to piece this together. He knows that they have that common community. All right, what about experience? Would somebody read verse 19 to verse 21? 19 to 21. Okay, thank you. Yeah, how did I end up here in your courtroom? Well, it's because all I did was listen to God. All I did was obey this vision. Like, this was too big, and it just changed everything. And I just followed through on what God told me to do. So here's kind of my list. You're an expert in the matters of this community. And the facts, these are the facts that are the background of this choice. And here's this experience that has changed everything. Paul not only does this in Acts 22 and Acts 26, but he does it in the chapters that are in between here as well. Flip back to Acts chapter 23. Can I get a volunteer to read verse 6? Acts chapter 23 and verse 6. Thanks. Very good. You know, he recognized that instead of taking all the heat, he could get them arguing with each other. So let's get the Pharisees and the Sadducees to argue with each other. So he yells out, "I'm a Pharisee, and I believe in the hope of the resurrection." And of course, the chapter continues that the Sadducees are like, "We don't even believe in that resurrection stuff." And he gets them arguing with each other. But his whole defense is, "I have hope. I have a hope. And it is based in the fact that I'm a Pharisee and you guys are Pharisees too. You have the same hope." He's establishing that kind of common ground, and it makes his message more believable. Come to chapter 24. Look at chapter 24. I'm going to pick up in verse 10. "When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, 'Knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense, since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Nor can they prove to you the charges which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets.'" And you can talk to your denominational friends and say, like, "Look, I know you think we're crazy because we don't have a rock band on Sunday morning. I know you think we're crazy because we don't do this or we don't. But look, I'm just following God according to all the prophets, according to all that has been written. I'm just trying to do what is in the scriptures." We can make these things more believable when, in addition to facts and information, we also share community and experience. And here's a few of the things that I actually think become more believable. It is believable that we would fully submit to the authority of the scriptures. That we would say, especially maybe to our denominational friends, like, "Look, you believe faith is essential. You believe confession is essential. I believe all of it is important. I believe that we have to follow God and keep His commandments in everything, whether it's how we worship or how our families function or marriage. Like, I believe that." And the simplicity of being just a Christian. You need to know this term. This is growing in popularity. A dude posted about it on Twitter the other day and it just blew up. Evangelical. Has anybody heard that term yet? Evangelical. You haven't heard that one. Okay. You know the term evangelical, right? Evangelical basically means in America, you're kind of Southern Baptist. Like, evangelical means like you're just kind of like this basic Christian that believes in the fundamentals of the Bible. And typically, it is evangelical churches that get super wrapped up in politics. And so this dude posted on Twitter the other day. He was like, "Is there a term other than ex-evangelical that would describe someone who still believes Jesus is the Son of God, who wants to follow him, but is just sick of," and he says, "gestures at everything, all the political garbage, all of the excuses that are made for the immorality of people in both parties." He's like, "Is there any term for somebody that just believes in Jesus?" And he said, "I've settled on the term theologically homeless." That is sad to me. And guys, you know believers. You know people that believe in Jesus Christ, but they are so sick of the political garbage that has infiltrated so many American churches. You can actually tell them, "You know what? At our church, it's really not about politics. It's about a kingdom that is not of this world. It's about a kingdom that Jesus has established where in our hearts we are living in submission to Him rather than what's happening in the world around us." And there are people in your generation hungry for just being a Christian. And you can introduce them to other people who just follow the Bible and who just are Christians. And we're not like taking a vote on changing doctrine. We're just submitting ourselves to the Bible It's the necessity of baptism to cover the, like all of these other people, they've been baptized. The honor and dignity of every human being. We'll talk about this more tomorrow, but Genesis chapter 1, 26 and 27, that we are all created in the image of God, is a crucial text for us to master, to truly have it ready when we need to talk to people about the dignity and equality of every human being. These things become more believable. So, how can you get more green lights in your conversations with your friends using these three plausibility things: facts and information, community, and experience? Number one, bring that community experience into the conversation. Show them that you are not a lone wolf. Show them that there is these connections with other disciples and that there are actually people all over this country and all over the world who are seeking to follow God faithfully. Give them a broader picture so they can see the positives of a local eldership functioning the way the scriptures talks about. So they can see the positives in brothers and sisters that are sharpening one another and taking time out of their schedules to be together. Secondly, inviting the lost to share activities that introduce them to Christian friends. Yes, it's great if you invite them to come to worship and to have time for Bible study, but there's just this reality that they need to meet Christian people in other places. If a bunch of you guys are going bowling, you need to be thinking, who is my non-Christian friend that I can invite to go bowling with us? If somebody's having a birthday party or it's just Taco Tuesday, you need to be thinking, who is my non-Christian friend that can come to this birthday party or come to Taco Tuesday, and they can just meet all these other people and they'll be like, so how do you guys all know each other? Are y'all in class together? And you go, actually, I go to this church and they go to this church and they go to this church, but we're all Christians. That's what we have in common. That's what binds us together. And they start looking, kind of are a lot of you here. You need those kind of opportunities. Second or thirdly, being a great listener. Please write this one down. I want you to ask your friends, what did your grandmother believe about God? And then practice your listening skills. Because I get it. This generation has been so, they've either been in watered down churches or in no churches or in churches that they are, can't wait to get out of because they've lost an understanding of how relevant and important this is, but their grandparents probably not. And you can start a conversation just saying, what did your grandmother believe about the Bible? What'd your grandma believe about God? Like, did she go to church anywhere? What do you? And just let them unpack that story. And it's likely to lead for opportunities for you to talk about differences in your faith. You know what Tracy and I found out we have in common? Both of our fathers grew up in the exact same denomination. And both of them left that denomination looking for the truth. It's like, whoa, never knew that. But like there are people that are out there and they are looking. So ask, what did your grandmother believe about God? And really listen. And then third, just ways that you extend hospitality. And yes, I'm kind of already touching on that when I mentioned birthday parties and Taco Tuesday, but here's really what I mean. Find a 15-minute activity, find a half an hour activity, and find a few hour activity. So like, I just want to have coffee with you. Or like, let's just go get ice cream. Or hey, have you got time? Let's just go get a donut and hang out for a few minutes. Like something that is brief, something that is short, but just something that takes your relationship with this non-Christian outside of the, hey, we're all in the same class of 100 people in intro to chemistry this semester. Like, let's actually go do something. Like, let's just go to the library together and grab this book. Would you just walk with me to the library and then I'll see you later? A 15-minute activity. And then, hey, can we just grab lunch? Like, can we just hit up Chick-fil-A or can we go to Moe's or can we just something for lunch? And then, hey, can we just sit down and have a couple hours together and we can visit and we can like really get to know each other? Those are those steps in our hospitality that allows people to gain their trust and to make these things that seem so unbelievable more believable. And I know you're kind of thinking, well, that sounds awfully easy, and I've tried those things before, and Philip, you just don't understand that when I try that, it never goes as planned. They either make an excuse, Or they say yes and then they back away. Like, it just never goes as planned. Is the topic today how to make evangelism always go as planned? No. The topic today is one small step. How do I take one small step and see what that actually produces? So take your Bibles back to Acts 16, please. Acts chapter 16, and I would love a volunteer to read verse 9 and verse 10 for me. Acts 16, verse 9 and verse 10. Who's got it? 9 and 10. Okay, thanks, Will. Very good. So things never go as planned, but one small step can create these unexpected opportunities. So it starts here with this Macedonian call. All right, Paul, I need you to go further than you thought you were ready to go. I know you were in Galatia and you were thinking about kind of going north, but I don't want you to go north, Paul. I want you to go west. I want you to go all the way over here to Philippi with this Macedonian call. And he's like, okay, Lord, you know, if that's what you want. So somebody read 13 to 15. 13 to 15 from Acts 16. Who's got 13 to 15? Oh, look. Oh, I love how everybody covered their name badges all of a sudden. Okay, 13 to 15. Can you read it for me? Great. So I wish that was where the chapter stopped, because it would be like, hey, look, he took one small step and then he met this amazing person named Lydia and she believed and she was baptized and her whole household and she was really hospitable and it was great. But actually what I want you to see in this chapter is what happened next. The demon-possessed girl. Right? Because then this crazy person comes out of nowhere and is super annoying. And I know that when you came to the workshop today, you're like, I can't wait to meet super annoying people. That's what you were all rooting for today, right? The unexpected opportunity is this demon-possessed girl. And she comes and she is shouting and is driving Paul up the wall until finally he just casts out the demon. And that is where things change. Because yes, he got the Macedonian call. And yes, he got the low-hanging fruit, Lydia, who was already praying, who already believed. She immediately obeyed. But it was the jailer that he would have never met in any other fashion. And the point of these evangelism workshops and the point of this planning and this preparation and having this just set in our mind is that there are more people like the jailer right here in Bowling Green. There are more people like the jailer today that we need to meet. The unexpected opportunities bring the green lights that we could never, ever plan alone. And so as you just get filled up with the things that Eric is covering and the things that you're learning from all your various Bible teachers and all the different congregations you guys are a part of, I want you to be committed that I'm going to take that next step. And I'm just going to let God open those doors and bring those opportunities. And they won't always go as planned, but they can be more believable. And that one small step can make evangelism that feels really crazy actually really powerful and bear a lot of fruit in God's kingdom. Thank you so much for being part of class.